And now, a special Veterans Day tribute program, The Battle of Hamburger Hill.
Hello and welcome to this special Veterans Day tribute program. I'm Jerry Stewart. Today is a special day set aside all across our America to honor those who have served to protect our nation through their military service. And if you find yourself searching to see how America continues to be so free, look no further than our veterans. They are the ones who have paid the price for our freedom. And believe me, the price paid has not been a small one. Over the history of our great nation, hundreds of thousands of brave Americans have suffered and died to keep us free. And even those who appear to have no ill effect from their war service, so often they are suffering, still suffering, from the horrors of war. And that's why we have this day, not so that there can be a special sale or a game or an event, but so that we will remember. We must remember. And I encourage you this day, if you know someone who has served in military or is still serving today, I encourage you to call them, drop by their home or business, and tell them thank you. Walk into just about any cafe or coffee shop today. Find a group of veterans and tell them thank you. And when you do, they may act like it's no big deal, but believe me, your words of thanks will fill their hearts with pride. So make a special point to do that this Veterans Day. Now, today's program is especially close to my heart because it involves a time in our nation when I was just becoming a man. Our nation was in a war that no one liked, but we all knew what we wanted, victory for our troops. It was the Vietnam War. And on today's program, we will be looking at one particular battle in that war, the battle for Hill 937, a battle which was so harsh it came to be known as the Battle of Hamburger Hill. The battle took place from May the 10th to May the 20th, 1969. And what happened there in those 10 days is perhaps one of the harshest battles in all of that Vietnam War. Now, there's no way for me to tell the story of this battle on my own. I wasn't there. But three Vietnam vets have been kind enough to recount the story because they were there. Their names are Arthur Wicknick, Michael Smith, and Frank Boccia. I want to personally thank them here first for their selfless service to our nation by taking on such a horrible task, and second, for their willingness to tell this story today. Be warned, the story you're about to hear is not Hollywood. It is real. It is war. And now, the story of the Battle of Hamburger Hill. The year was 1969. It was a strange and difficult year here in America. In sports, the bumbling New York Mets won the World Series. And at the Super Bowl, the New York Jets defied all logic by defeating the highly favored Baltimore Colts. It was a silly year. The American astronauts had landed on the moon and bounced Silly Putty on the moon's surface. And Silly Putty became the rage. It was also a horrible and deadly year. The American death toll in the Vietnam War had reached 34,000. Peace talks continued in Paris, but there was no peace in Vietnam. And for those young Americans serving there, there were no demonstrations, no politics, no rights or wrongs, only duty, only service. But how did a young man find his way to the Vietnam War in 1969? I ask Arthur Wicknick that question.
I was drafted in April of 1968. I never wanted to go. I didn't want any part of it. I was having too much fun. But I was drafted, and that's the way it was back in the 60s. Even though I was only 19 when I was drafted, a young man that I went to school with had already been killed in Vietnam, and I felt that it would be an affront not to go. And it would be a disgrace to my parents if I fought against being drafted. And I went. I was a reluctant person. But when I look back, 40 years later, having gone through it, I'm very grateful for the experience. And I have so much respect for people today who go in because they're all volunteers. And they're doing something I would have never done, and that is volunteer.
And Michael Smith, he was one of those who volunteered.
I volunteered for the draft in 1968. My college career wasn't going well, so I volunteered for the draft and entered the service with the anticipation of being a helicopter pilot. However, that didn't work out. So in July of 68, I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic training and then advanced infantry training.
And Frank Boccia had quite a different story. He wasn't even a U.S. citizen, but he volunteered to go to Vietnam.
I was born in Rome in 1943. We came to the United States in 1947. My father was with semi-diplomatic status. So I grew up in the United States, but I was never an American citizen. When I graduated from Georgetown in 1966, I had to make a choice. And the choice was go back to Italy, where I would have had a fairly comfortable life, or stay in the United States. But the only way I could stay was to join the service. It was a pretty easy choice. I felt myself 100% American. I volunteered for the Army to go into officer training school. I entered in 1967, got to OCS at Fort Benning, Georgia in the summer of that year, got my commission in December of 1967, spent the next year at an Army post in Virginia. Arrived in Vietnam in December of 1968, was assigned to the 3rd Brigade of the 101st and the 3rd of the 187th.
I arrived in Vietnam in January of 1969. When I got to assignment squad, they saw that I had some experience in surveying, and they yanked me and sent me to a surveying company in Long Binh, Vietnam. But then after Tet occurred, casualties began to mount in the northern provinces. I was called, and I got to my company and battalion on May 1st of 1969. I got to the 3rd Battalion, the 187th.
The important point to mention here is that all across Vietnam, there were battles and skirmishes going on. But unlike a lot of what we read about in World War II, they really weren't big battles involving tens of thousands of troops. They were smaller, individual skirmishes and firefights going on constantly. And that is what made it so hard. Everywhere a soldier found himself was a potential kill zone.
On May 1st, I arrived at the battalion area, and they immediately assigned me to Company D. On the morning of the May 3rd, I was in the field. They were in a current operation in the Esau Valley. And for the next 3 days, we had a firefight, wounded in action, and men killed. First 5 days, I was with the unit. It was a very difficult time, even just before the beginning of Hamburger Hill.
Before we even got to Hamburger Hill, we had gone into Dong Nagai, which is another mountain along the Shaw Valley, and gotten into some very, very tough fighting there. By the time I did get to Hamburger Hill, I was experienced, my platoon was experienced, and we had already seen considerable action.
Before that May of 1969, military high command knew that one valley, the Eshaw Valley, had become a major infiltration corridor for communist forces from the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, and it sheltered enemy base 611. In this valley, there were a group of mountains, and one of these was the Ap Bia Mountain, called simply Hill 937 by the Americans because of its height in meters. This Hill 937 was of no strategic value to our forces, but it was to the enemy. The enemy was there, so it must be taken. The terrain was rugged. It was what they called a triple canopy jungle with dense thickets of bamboo and a heavy undergrowth of elephant grass. It had been an area long occupied by the enemy. It was heavily fortified with bunkers and tunnels and trenches. It was called the Mountain of the Crouching Beast by the local tribesmen. For 2 weeks prior to the first advance, the mountain was bombed and shelled, and landing zones were prepared in the valley below. Then came May the 10th, when 1,800 American soldiers were dropped into the valley. Although numerous battalions were there, we will be hearing the story from the vantage point of our three vets today. Frank Boccia, who was a platoon leader, 101st Airborne Division, 3rd Battalion, 187th Regiment, Company B. Michael Smith, also of the 187th Company D, and Arthur Wicknick of the 506th 2nd Battalion, Company A. The 3rd Battalion, 187th Regiment, drew the toughest assignment. They were given the frontline task to move cross-country to clear and then occupy the mountain. Both Michael Smith and Frank Baccia were in the 187th. On May the 10th, the 187th took the lead, and certain discoveries were made.
Along the way, we discovered the bodies of four NVA. We searched them, and the documents we found indicated that we were facing the 27th NVA regiment. It's one of the better regiments in the North Vietnamese Army. And we proceeded along the trail, it was a very well-marked trail, toward the summit of 937. My point man, who was a full-blooded Choctaw Indian and a very good tracker, was telling me there is something wrong. You could tell something was wrong. There was way too much debris, way too many footprints, blood trails. The NVA had never made it that easy for us before. This was an obvious trap.
I'm Jerry Stewart. The enemy has set the trap, and they're lying in wait. I'll return with more of this special Veterans Day tribute program after these messages. Hello and welcome back to this special Veterans Day tribute program. I'm Jerry Stewart. Today in my program, I'm telling you the story of one of the harshest and bloodiest battles in the Vietnam War, the Battle of Hamburger Hill. I want to thank again our three veterans who were there at that battle, giving us this first-hand account. The battle for Hill 937, Hamburger Hill, had started on May the 10th, 1969, and almost immediately, certain discoveries told those there that this was no ordinary hill. The enemy troops there were some of the best, and the hill was heavily fortified. Both Michael Smith and Frank Baccia were there from the beginning, each with the 187th Regiment, Michael Company D, Frank Company B. And what they saw playing out there was not good.
On the 10th, that was the first assault. We were very fortunate. We did not run into any of the enemy, any of the NVA on our portion of the combat assault with Delta Company. And on the 11th, the same thing. We were still securing the battalion headquarters, and the other companies, A, B, C, were going out looking for the bad guys, and they found them.
The problem with that area was that it was very dense triple canopy, huge primary trees, then very thick secondary trees, very small trees, bushes, vines, and so on. Very thick stuff. The trap was set so well, and the defensive posture along that clearing was so good. They immediately sprang the trap, killed three of his men, badly wounded him immediately within the first couple of seconds, and then it escalated from there. We pulled back, got the wounded out, got the dead out. At that point, we held a kind of a council of war with the company commander, trying to figure out what it was exactly that we had seen. By this time, we had begun to realize we were not facing a company. The resistance on all three fronts, Charlie Company's, Delta's, and ours in the middle, was far too great for just one company. It began to dawn on us that we were facing probably a full regiment.
So here on the 11th, as if all of this wasn't enough for the troops to face, something else, something horrible happened. Bravo Company came under heavy machine gun fire with rocket-propelled grenades, so they called in a U.S. Cobra gunship to help them. But instead of helping, there was disaster.
It was just no warning, sudden, out of the sky, clear blue sky, as a matter of fact. We were fired up from the wrong direction with friendly fire. They made a firing run in 180 degrees opposite the direction they were supposed to and released their aerial rocketry on the ridgeline that the battalion headquarters were on.
Sadly, unbelievably, friendly fire. Their own gunships had attacked them. Two were dead. 35 were wounded. How did it happen? Those in charge were coming to face this harsh reality. The thick jungle, the giant trees, were making it almost impossible for those in the air to clearly identify the enemy targets. This would be the first of five friendly fire incidents during that battle. And something else on that hill was fighting against them.
The ridge along which we traveled was a razorback ridge, falling very steeply to the sides. That meant you were limited to one man at a time climbing that ridge until you got to the clearing. This hampered our efforts tremendously. We could not bring up a second platoon to help. You just didn't have the space to bring anybody up. It was one of the best laid, best planned, and best executed defensive locations I have ever heard of. It was a killing zone. It was designed to kill as many of us as possible, make it as difficult as possible to get through.
So imagine the scene. Hundreds of U.S. troops, multiple regiments with companies, all working to position themselves to get to the top of that Hamburger Hill and to take out the enemy. Many times they had come so close, but always repelled back by an enemy force superior in numbers that was well entrenched in spider holes and bunkers, continuing to be stocked and reinforced. And because of that narrow ridgeline, only small numbers of men could travel up at a time, and making heavy weapon use almost impossible. And what was the goal? Take the top of the hill. They saw the top. They saw the clearing. But it was a kill zone that they just couldn't reach.
What became known as the clearing. It was a level, cleared area within 75 meters or so of the top of the hill. That was the kill zone.
Over the next few days, as Frank Baccia and his Company B continued their efforts to take the hill from their side, Michael Smith and his Company D ran into a barrage of enemy fire. And as they worked to take care of their wounded, what followed was just too much for any soldier to have to see or endure.
On the 13th, we began to go down from our ridgeline down through this small little valley and cross the stream. And we had been the first platoon. And when we got to the bottom of the stream, it was our turn to take a break. So they moved us out upstream and downstream to provide security. We were hit by some small arms fire and RPG rounds. And one of the RPG rounds hit next to my position. And everyone in my fire team except me was wounded. So they were kept there in the bottom of the stream, and I went with three other guys from what was left of my squad. And a platoon sergeant came up and said, okay, and you guys head on up to the top with the first platoon. So we started up that objective, which was the next ridgeline, the next top of the hill. And we were all three-quarters of the way up. First platoon was already up on top. Company commander was up there. And from somewhere, a medevac came in. He hovered into the position down at the stream bed where the rest of the company was gathered and these wounded. And he began to hover down, and he was below the top of the mountain in the ridgeline. And you can see the top of his rotors. The NVA at that time fired an RPG and hit the medevac right in the rotor system, right in the top. Immediately exploded and fell straight down on people in Delta Company at the bottom of the stream. It killed two men on the ground. One was one of my friends. And it killed three members in the helicopter. Only one survived from the crash. So at that point, we had 12 or 15 people wounded on the ground, two killed, three in the helicopter. We had a massive amount of casualties, and we were out here on our own. We moved to pull our casualties and killed up out of the stream to an intermediate position on the 13th. It took all day on the 14th with help from Alpha Company to carry our wounded and the killed out of there. It took almost a day and a half to be able to extract ourselves from that position. My job was to carry the body bags of the helicopter crew. We had to get them out of there too. So that was a real struggle to carry them up out of there in teams of three and four people. Real exhausting. You didn't talk a whole lot because it was a soldier in there. And we did it in shifts and took different sections to be able to climb up out of there with them. And that was pretty, just very unusual feeling because that's the first time I'd had to do that. And I didn't know which bag contained my friend who was cut in half by the helicopter blades when the thing came down. I didn't know if I was carrying him or who. I just didn't know. This is very, very unreal, I guess, is the way you would say it.
So as Michael and his fellow soldiers struggled to bring the dead and wounded out, of course, the battle on the hill raged on. The killing, the horror continued. On that night of the 14th, as the survivors assumed their night defensive positions, they could see enemy campfires, cooking fires, up on the mountaintop above them. They counted more than 100. The enemy was there, and they didn't care if the U.S. troops knew it. All of them hunkered down for the night, with no assurance of their tomorrow, only the horrific memories of today. I'm Jerry Stewart. I'm taking a break now, but after this break, more of the battle for Hamburger Hill after these messages. And now we return to the Battle of Hamburger Hill. Hello and welcome back to this special Veterans Day tribute program. I'm Jerry Stewart. On today's program, we are honoring our military veterans and are focusing on one battle in the Vietnam War, which was so harsh, so destructive, it became known as the Battle of Hamburger Hill. We have three veterans today, three Vietnam veterans, who were there at that battle, telling their own recount of what happened there. They are Frank Baccia, Michael Smith, and Arthur Wicknick. And so far, most of the story has been told by Frank and Michael because they were there at that 10-day battle from the first day, which began May the 10th, 1969. They were both with the Army 3rd Battalion, 187th Airborne. Arthur, who was with the 2nd Battalion, 506th Airborne, did not come into the battle until his battalion was brought in on the 18th. By the 18th, many battalions, many of their companies, had fought to get to the top of that hill, and many had died trying with hundreds wounded. The great problem was not only that the enemy was so entrenched in their bunkers and tunnels, but even more, there was not enough room on the ridges up to the top to bring in large manpower all at once. So the enemy continued to take pot shots and to heave grenades at the small groups coming up the hill from all sides. And then, horribly, there was the friendly fire. The heavy jungle was so dense, so confusing to those coming in with air support, it made it hard for them to know just where the enemy was. Frank and his company saw it, experienced it firsthand.
The next day, we were to make yet another assault. This time, Charlie Company got into some real heavy contact to our south, and they brought in F-104s on a bombing run. And this is one of the bad moments. They brought in the F-104s to bomb the NVA positions. Because of the nature of the terrain, the steepness of it, we actually became in the path of the F-104s. And a couple of their bombs overshot the target. And I lost one man killed and one badly wounded. It disrupted our attack, and we had to be pulled back.
As Frank's Bravo Company pulled back to regroup and to attend to their wounded, the other companies pushed forward, fighting up the hill. There were bullets and explosions everywhere.
People started getting hit almost immediately. A majority of them were, you know, they were walking wounded. They would turn around and they'd pass off their ammunition to somebody as they headed back. And it was just like, it's all in slow motion. You know, you're stepping over stuff. You're hearing bullets. My job was to lob M79 rounds off to the left, down into this ravine. I'm now out of ammunition, so I've grabbed an M16 and a bunch of clips and bandoliers from wounded guys. And off to the left of us is this very large bomb crater that the rest of the platoon is trying to go through to begin to go farther up. And everyone who went in there got wounded. By that time, every officer in our company was wounded. And there was no one left in charge. And off to our right, 3rd Platoon, and we could see them. And we could see them begin to get hit badly. They were throwing grenades down upon them, just like slow motion, and you watch the grenade fly through the air. The expressions on the 3rd Platoon leader and his platoon sergeant, he saw it fall right in front of him, and the next thing you know, you see Lieutenant Liscombe just raise up in the air like in slow motion. He was killed instantly, of course. At some point, you know, everything just ground to a halt because there was no manpower left. There was nobody left to go up because everyone had been wounded. We were in the rain, we were running out of ammunition, and we'd run out of soldiers on the 18th.
So, on that 18th day of May, after 9 days in battle with so many dead and hundreds wounded, High Command had only one solution. They needed more manpower. Not just manpower, but fresh troops. So, on that 18th, new troops were requisitioned. One of these was Arthur Wicknick's 506th 2nd Battalion. Arthur Wicknick was about to enter the battle for Hamburger Hill.
The morning of the 18th, we were flown out to the Eshaw Valley floor, and within an hour or two, two helicopters came out with chaplains in it. And it was a Sunday, so at first I didn't think too much of that. But why would the chaplains be coming out here to see us? They could have talked to us back at the base camp. They came out and asked us if anybody wants to have confession or take communion or anything like that. A few guys did. So they stayed for an hour or so, then they left. And, of course, a lot of guys are whispering, what are we in for? What's going to happen to us? What do they expect? We started flying around in this large circle. And while we're flying in the circle, we can see a very brown hill against all that green backdrop. So we knew that that's where the action is. That's where we're going.
When Arthur's helicopter got him and the other troops to their drop-off point, they had to literally jump out of the helicopter from 7 to 8 feet off the ground with a full pack and gear. Arthur jumped out and scrambled up the hill for cover, and there he was, Major General Melvin Zayas.
I felt kind of good to see the two-star general, you know, right there. You know, he's running the whole operation. You know, it also told me that this cannot be a good thing. This has got to be something really big.
I'm Jerry Stewart. A short break here in a moment, the taking of Hamburger Hill. Hello and welcome back to this special Veterans Day tribute program. I'm Jerry Stewart. The date, May the 20th, 1969. The place, the Ashaw Valley in Vietnam, Dong Ap Bia Mountain, known by the U.S. forces as Hill 937. It has now become Hamburger Hill. Thousands of American forces had been fighting there to take this hill for 10 days, but up to this 20th day of May, no American soldier had made it to the top and lived to tell about it. The U.S. troops have been decimated. Although casualties to the enemy have far exceeded the Americans, a great price has been paid by the U.S. forces there, and the hill has still not been taken.
Bravo Company was destroyed. There were less than half of us left. Every officer in the company was wounded. We're very lightly wounded, so we did not evacuate. But everyone else was either killed or badly wounded. Most of our NCOs were gone. If you're a historian, you know that the Civil War, which was one of the bloodiest conflicts in history, would consider the Army considered a battalion destroyed if it suffered 50% casualties. We had taken 60%.
The Army commanding officers had a difficult decision to make. By this time, the news media had caught on to what was happening on this hill, and they were bringing the already heated battle to an even higher boiling point. As if that wasn't enough, Senator Ted Kennedy was being quite vocal in his assessment of the battle. He called it nothing but cruelty and savagery. General Zayas could have called off the entire attack and moved his troops along. After all, it was true. His troops had suffered heavily. The 187th A and B companies had lost 50% of their original strength. Companies C and D had lost 80%. And of the four original company commanders, one was dead, one was wounded, with casualties among 8 of the 12 platoon leaders. No doubt this hill, 937, was a killing zone. But General Zayas would not hear of quitting. The enemy was there on Hamburger Hill, and the U.S. military's job was to take them out. So the decision was made. Today would be an all-out attack, an all-out effort to take the hill. This would be the day.
I'm thinking, after 9 days, there's not going to be anybody up there. They're all dead. This is going to be easy. That's the thought I was trying to get in my head. This is going to be easy. We just got to go up that hill and take the top. But I was wrong. First thing that occurred was there was some shooting real close to us very early in the morning. And what had happened is an NVA soldier had walked up to one of our positions like he was going to give up. But he had his hands behind his head. And what he had in one of his hands was a grenade. So what he was going to do was, walk up to a group of GIs and throw that grenade when he got close enough. Well, somebody recognized it, and they shot him down where he stood. Within 5 minutes, word came down that we were told to fix our bayonets, and that's something I didn't want to hear either because that meant the possibility of hand-to-hand combat. So everybody put their bayonets on, and then 5 minutes later, another command came down and said, we are not taking any prisoners today. Each one of those commands ran a chill through me because I'm thinking, man, this was going to be my worst living nightmare. I might have to stab somebody, or and I got to make sure whoever I, if I see anybody, I have to kill them. I had never fired my weapon at an enemy soldier yet. I had been in Vietnam only about a month, so I had not experienced any of this. Everybody knew, you know, this is a big, huge deal, and if you want to survive, you're going to do just what you were told.
And then came the bombardment of the hill before the attack.
There was a two-hour bombardment of every fire base in the valley was firing artillery rounds into the hill to prep the mountain for our final assault. And once the bombardment stopped, the command was given, let's go, and we broke out into the open. So I'm going across there, and again, I had never been in combat. I had never been shot at or shot at anybody. And I see these guys crawling and rolling around and firing, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to use up all my bullets. And there's so much shooting going on that you can't distinguish anything. You know, you got 700 GIs are all firing at the same time at this hill. There's just a lot of bullets, a lot of firepower going at that hill. So you couldn't really hear anything or distinguish too much.
As Arthur and the other soldiers made their way up the hill, heavy fire continued. He heard the shots. He saw the puffs of smoke from the enemy rifles, but he never actually saw anyone. Suddenly, he felt a serious pain in his chest, and he was thrown back by the impact.
So I knew then I had been hit, and I figured, great, this is going to be it. I'm just going to die right here. As I lay there, I figured I would just drift off, but the pain was getting more and more intense. I said, geez, I got to suffer now before I die? And then when I looked down at my chest, my shirt's on fire. I'm burning, so I beat out the fire. And when I'm looking at my chest, all my magazines, I had like four or five bandoliers of ammunition wrapped around my chest.
The enemy fire had hit him in the chest, but somehow his magazines around his chest had stopped the bullet. He was not really wounded by the shot at all.
So I got up, I started running towards that. I yelled to the guys, follow me, we're going up. And I just started going up that hill. I was actually running. My adrenaline just took over. The training took over. You know, go get the objective. I got up to the top. When I turned around to tell the guys we're going to set up here, there was nobody there. Nobody followed me.
Although Arthur saw no other U.S. soldiers up there, and even though he was hearing enemy voices, fortunately, the heavy bombardment and the fighting up that mountain had either killed the enemy or had driven them into a retreat. Hill 937, Hamburger Hill, was taken. The U.S. troops had won the battle, but now the cleaning up, the searching for the dead and wounded, the realization that so many who had been there just 10 days before, now so many were gone.
Later that day on the 20th, again, by going up and looking for Americans killed that were unable to be pulled back on the 18th, that was a very difficult day.
I had guys like Dennis Helms, my North Carolina boy. He was my RTO. Nate Hyde, Louisiana guy, young sergeant. John Snyder, farmer's boy from Pennsylvania. Tim Logan, a kid from Indianapolis. Miles Westman from northern Minnesota. If you knew these men, as I did, you knew the strength of America.
I don't regret my experience in Vietnam. I wouldn't trade it for anything, but I would trade to take the place of some of my friends.
And one last question I had for Frank Boccia. Did he ever become a U.S. citizen?
I was granted citizenship in October of 1969. I was flown to Hawaii, and about 300 of us were given citizenship in one ceremony. I'd seen enough of the world to know that this was the greatest country ever. Worth dying for. I will die for the United States of America. This is my country.
My thanks again to these three veterans for telling their story today and for their great service and their great sacrifice on Hamburger Hill in Vietnam. I'm Jerry Stewart. I'll be back with some final thoughts after these messages. Hello and welcome back to this special Veterans Day tribute program. I'm Jerry Stewart. Today is Veterans Day, a special day set aside to honor our U.S. military veterans. Here's the truth of it. We could speak every day, every moment of every day, in honor of our veterans. And truly, we could never say enough. The Bible says, greater love hath no man than this, but to lay down his life for his friends. And the love and sacrifice given by our veterans over our history is truly beyond measure. But as I mentioned at the start of today's program, I have a particular sensitivity for those who served in Vietnam during that horrible war. Maybe it's because I could have been there myself but didn't have to go. Maybe it's because I knew so many who did go. My friends, my neighbors, my relatives. Some never came back. But I believe the real reason I think so much about our Vietnam veterans is because I saw firsthand how badly so many of them were treated when they returned back home. Now, I never understood that attitude by some of our U.S. citizens, that they would be so shallow and insensitive to take their dislike for a war against those who were there only doing their duty. Some like Arthur Wicknick, who admitted today, he made it clear, he did not want to be in Vietnam, but he went. After our interview, I asked Arthur how it was for him when he returned back home.
When we came home, Vietnam vets did not get a good welcome home, but that's the way it was back then. When I came home, I landed at Bradley Field, and I was the only person in uniform. It's a small airport, but I was the only person in uniform, and I'm looking around. I thought that was a little odd, but didn't think too much of it. And then I was waiting for my ride to pick me up. I sat in a waiting area, and those other people came in. They saw me there, and they'd kind of flinch and look back and kind of back away and sit in different areas. And then I realized, wait a minute. And as more and more people fed into that waiting area, people would rather sit on the floor than sit in either seat on the sides of me. On my left and my right, those seats were left empty. And then I knew I had to get home and get out of this uniform. And you look at the people coming and going to war today, they're reaping the benefit of what we experienced with a very poor welcome home and a very poor send-off. And whenever I see that, whenever I see somebody in uniform, because I was never able to walk around in my uniform when I came home, to me, that's a welcome home for me. Because if it wasn't for the way we were treated, these men and women today probably would not be treated as well. So I look at that as my homecoming, and I get homecomings every day this way.
Wow, what a wonderful and gracious attitude. Thank you, Arthur, for your kind and forgiving spirit. It was General Douglas MacArthur who said this, "Always for them, duty, honor, country, always their blood and sweat and tears as they saw the way and the light driving home to their objective and for many to the very judgment seat of God. I don't know the dignity of their birth, but I do know the glory of their death. They died unquestioning, uncomplaining, with faith in their hearts and on their lips, the hope that we would go on to victory." Well, that's all the show for today. I'm Jerry Stewart saying goodbye for now. May God bless our veterans. May God bless America. And may God bless you.